Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me today is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
And hello, everyone. I hope it's warmer there than it is here.
Oh, come on. It's not so bad for November.
No, it's not. I know.
So how have you been reading much this week, Mom?
Yes, I have. I have. I read our book, and then I read it again.
Wow.
And because I thought, there's just so much in it, just a tremendous amount of things in it. And the title is heavy, but to me, it's about a lot more than weight. There's a lot more than just heavy about weight. It's heavy about a lot of things.
Why don't you introduce our author?
Okay. Kisei, was that how you know it?
Kisei.
Yeah. Okay. And he is a Black Southern writer, born and raised in Jackson, Mississippi. He attended Millsaps College and Jackson State University before graduating from Oberlin College. He earned an MFA in fiction from Indiana University. He is currently a professor of English and creative writing at the University of Mississippi. He's the author of the award-winning novel Long Division and a collection of essays, How to Slowly Kill Yourself and Others in America. He has written for numerous publications, including New York Times, NPR, Los Angeles Times, Esquire, The Guardian, McSweeney's, Color Lines, The Best American Series, Ebony, and many others. He is a contributing author of Oxford American. And he taught at Vassar for many, many years, and that's when this is a memoir, and there was a great deal about that in the book. So, welcome to Writer's Voices.
Thank y'all for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, I was very impressed with your writing, with your book. It really was eye opening. It really was.
Thanks for reading it twice.
Yeah.
And Caroline is a retired English teacher, so
she
was probably checking your grammar.
No, I really wasn't. No, I gave that up. Gave that up a long time ago.
Okay.
But your mother was always checking your grammar, wasn't she?
Oh,
yes.
Definitely. I mean, she still checks the grammar even on emails.
How about text?
Even on text messages. Yeah, text messages too. Absolutely.
So what is she doing now? Is she still
she runs a nonprofit that focuses on trying to get more resources to single women who are out of work and have kids up in the Northeast. So
okay.
Yeah.
She gets around. She's been different places then, hasn't she?
Well, she was in Mississippi for most of our lives, and so she just moved up. She just moved to the Northeast probably about 5 years ago or so. Yeah.
And okay. You moved back to Mississippi.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I always wanted to come back, and then I knew I needed to come back with a few things under my arm. So, when I got a few books done and got a lot more professional security, I thought it was time. And I needed to finish this book. I thought it was time to come home.
Wow. So, Heavy is a memoir, and it deals with your relationship with your mother, which is why we are asking about her, your experiences with racism, with addiction, with weight issues, and how the world treats people who don't fit the, the norm in terms of body size.
Right. Right.
It seems like, at least in the early part of your book, you had a pretty rough childhood.
So teaching at Vassar, one of the things that you experience is, especially cause when I got my job at Vassar, I was 26. So I would, a lot of my students would come try to talk to me about the hard time they were having transitioning from high school to college, and doing that, they would talk about their childhoods. And so, you know, I guess my childhood was sort of rough or hard, but, like, the more I talk to kids and adults, like, I think a lot of us had pretty rough childhoods. Whether we're able to articulate that roughness is a different story. But it was definitely rough, but it was also, as rough as it was also loving.
Yes, I and of course your grandmother was, your grandmama was also, was a very important part of that, wasn't she?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And so, you know, I just don't, I mean, there's some people who don't have the privilege of having a grandmother like I did, who was just, you know, she was just really good at loving people. Mm-hmm. And my mother, you know, she had me when she was really young, and she was good actually at loving people too. She just came up on a rough patch in life when I was growing up. You know, with abusive relationships and money problems and stuff. And I think given what she was facing, I think she did, you know, a pretty good job. I mean, I think she could have done a better job, like most of us. But, you know, I don't know what it's like to be 19 years old and have a little black boy in central Mississippi. You know what I mean? Like, I ask her about that. So I'm trying to be empathetic and thoughtful about what she experienced, but I'm also want to be honest and say that as rough as my childhood was, it was also definitely loving.
Mm. How does, is your grandmama still alive?
She's still alive, yes.
So oh, wonderful.
How does she and your mother feel about you sort of exposing the secrets of your family in this memoir?
Well, you know, the most salacious stuff I did not expose, like, because I do still have a family I have to come home to and see. So they were, you know, they were supportive of it, but they were part of the project all along. You know, when I sold this book to Bloomsbury and initially and then to Scribner later, it was a weight loss book. I was going to lose 150 pounds while talking to my mother and my grandmother about their relationships to food and their relationships to sexual violence. And so I did that for a few years. And after a while, I was like, okay, this project really needs to be my talking back to them after some of the things they've talked to me about. So when the book came out, it wasn't like they were surprised, because they had been part of the process all along. You know, I needed to hear their memories. I needed to know what they thought about my memories in order to write this kind of book.
But still, it must have been hard to negotiate.
Oh, yeah, it's hard. It's hard, definitely, because family, you know, whatever, you know, I think regardless of where your family's from, there are a lot of things most families don't want made public. But, you know, my grandmother raised a daughter who raised a son to become a writer. And so, you know, part of what I have to do is look at my life and intersections with my life and their lives and try to make art of it. And my mama made it. So my mama made me into a writer. So I didn't have to write this particular book, but I think I needed to write this particular book for us, to give us the chance to confront all our relationships with each other and our relationships to different kinds of addiction and really our relationships to this country.
Well, mm-hmm. Kiese, why don't you read the introduction to the book? Because I think that kind of says a little bit of what we're talking about right now.
Okay, yeah. So the beginning chapter, sort of like a prologue, is called Ben. I did not want to write to you. I wanted to write a lie. I did not want to write honestly about black lies, black thighs, black loves, black laughs, black foods, black addictions, black stretch marks, black dollars, black words, black abuses, black blues, black belly buttons, black wins, black bends, black blends, black consent, black parents, or black children. I did not want to write about us. I wanted to write an American memoir. I wanted to write a lie. I wanted to do that old black work of pandering and lying to folk who pay us to pander and lie to them every day. I wanted to write about our family's relationships to simple carbohydrates, deep fried meats, and high fructose corn syrup. I wanted the book to begin with my weighing 319 pounds and end with my weighing 165 pounds. I wanted to pepper the book with acerbic warnings to us fat black folk in the Deep South and saccharine sentimental exhortations from Grandmama. I did not want you to laugh. I wanted to write a lie. I wanted to write about how fundamental, present black fathers, responsible black mothers, magical black grandmothers, and perfectly disciplined black children are to our liberation. I wanted to center a something, a someone who wants us dead and dishonest. I wanted white Americans who have proven themselves even more unwilling to confront their lies, to reconsider how their lies limit our access to good love, healthy choices, and second chances. I wanted the book to begin and end with the assumption that if white Americans reckon with their insatiable appetites for black American suffering, and we reckon with our insatiable appetites for unhealthy food, we could all be ushered into a reformed era of American prosperity. I wanted to create a fantastic literary spectacle. I wanted that literary spectacle to ask nothing of you, Grandmama, or me, other than our adherence to a low-carb diet, limited sugar, weightlifting, 12,000 steps a day, gallons of water, and no eating after midnight. I wanted you to promise. I did not want you to remember. I wanted to write a lie. I wanted that lie to be titillating. I wrote that lie. It was titillating. You would have loved it. I discovered nothing. You would have loved it. I started over and I wrote what we hoped I'd forget.
And that's Kiese Lehman reading from Heavy, an American memoir. So you actually sold this book as you were going to lose 150 pounds while you were writing it?
Yeah, the point was going to be like, it was going to be like a new kind of weight loss book where we, because I just gained like 150 pounds and I was like, all right, I'm going to lose it and I'm going to talk to my family about our relationships to food and weight. And yeah, and in doing that, I realized that there were, I needed to talk about weight, but a much more meaningful kind of weight, you know, not just food, not just calories. And I needed to talk about secrets and lies and, you know, joyful things too. But I just, so along the way, I just shifted. I wrote that book. It was sort of interesting, but not really. And then I was like, all right, let me just do what I really am afraid to do, which is to write back to my mom about a lot of things that we never talked about.
I imagine this happens a lot in a lot of families, don't you suppose? This you know,
Hello?
they would like to talk about things, but it just never gets done.
Wow. So did writing this to your mom and you're using a kind of a literary technique of addressing the book to your mother or the stories to your mother. Although you sort of step out of that at times too, but in doing this, did you resolve some of these unresolved issues from your past? Hello?
I think we lost him.
I think you're right. You still there, Mom?
Yeah.
All right, let me try getting him on again. Let's see. Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
Yes.
Not sure what happened there.
I'm not sure either. I was talking, and then I kept saying hello, and y'all weren't on the other end.
Yeah.
Well, I was asking you a question, and anyway, we can edit that part out. So what I was asking you was, you were using this, you're writing this to your mother.
Right.
And in doing so, do you feel like you were able to work through some of these unresolved issues from the past?
I think we have been able to start working through. a lot of the issues. But the book is also about how a lot of times families want that first conversation to be the last conversation. And I think in my family, at least, we're very obsessed with the idea of resolution. So like, okay, we've dealt with that. We don't have to deal with it anymore, like that kind of thing. But that's not at all, I think, how life really works. And I
Yeah.
think, I don't think things really get dealt with if they're just talked about once or twice. So the book helped us begin to do work that we should have been doing a long time ago, but that work is not over at all.
There's a section early in the book about your mother taking you to a psychologist. Can you tell me a little bit more about why she did that and what she was trying to accomplish? And you were what, 12? Something like
I
that?
was 12 at the time. So I was getting in trouble in school, and I think, again, parents can just see things in children sometimes we don't know they see, and vice versa. And I just experienced a lot of something strange at this house that I used to go over and stay. And I think she could just see a change in my behavior, and like, I think she could see that there was something not so right. But also at school, I was just getting in trouble all the time, and I was really angry. And she just thought, okay, let's go to a psychiatrist, or one of her friends who was a psychologist, or maybe I think her friend was like a I don't think her friend actually was a real psychologist. I think she was trying to become one. She was in school, and and we went, and she stayed in the room with me the whole time. So I just remember looking at her, and like, I was just like, "Why am I here?" Like, I'm not gonna tell this woman, but you don't have to worry about me telling her any of your business. But at the same time, why did we come? And then the only thing she did is she literally gave. She just told us we should count to 10. That's what she said. She said, "When everything gets, when things get bad, you should, go outside and count 10 stars. Or if you're in the classroom, just go to the bathroom and count to 10, and everything will be okay." So
So it
I
wasn't
saw
real
that at the
helpful.
time. I thought, well, at the time, when you, it's just like any doc, it's like anybody who's a doctor, if they tell you anything, especially if you're a kid, you believe it. So I was like, oh my God, like all I've got to do is count to 10, and I tried it. I tried it for a while. Tried it.
Wow. Now, this house that you went to, there were some very disturbing things happening there. Why didn't you tell your mom about some of these things?
I mean, I just didn't know what the language to use. You know what I mean? Like I would, what would I, I was at that age one where you don't tell your mother what's happening with you and your friends, right? And then I just didn't know what to say. I didn't know, I guess I would have said, "Ma, at so and so's house, these three boys took my friend into a room, and I don't know what happened, but I think they had sex." But to even talk about it, I would have had to talk about sex, and sex was something we just never ever talked about. I didn't want to talk to her about sex, and obviously she didn't want to talk to me about sex because she never did. And then we would have had to talk about all kinds of, I just didn't know how. It wasn't modeled for me, and I didn't know how. But I tried to write to my grandmother about it, and because I trusted that my grandmother would somehow make it all okay, because she always made everything okay. And then when I wrote about it to her, she didn't know what to say either. She was going through her own trials and tribulations, and she didn't know what to do other than pray. So I just think that we just didn't have any models for talking about sexual violence. And when I was a kid growing up in central Mississippi, I think kids might have more now, but back then there was no model for it. There was no model for it.
Wow. And you talk in the book about how black m boys are taught to abuse black girls.
Yeah, I mean, I think boys, period. But I was speaking specifically about my neighborhood. There were no white people. Everybody was black. And so really I'm trying to name patriarchy without naming it, right? Like, you know, boys taught boys taught boys taught boys, who were taught by men, who are often taught by public policy, who are often taught by presidents, who are often taught by television. And I think we were taught, like, not that you should not harm women, but that, like, Black women particularly could survive any harm you inflicted upon them. That was the unspoken, that was the unspoken thing we were taught. And I think the nation actually teaches men that too, women generally, right? Like, they'll be okay, you know, like, she'll be all right and all that kind of stuff.
It's
So
not that big a
it,
deal.
right, it's exactly, it's not that big a deal. She'll get over it, you know what I mean? And that is one of the reasons we are where we are today, right? Because I think people are taught that exact thing, and there's consequences, like big time, big consequences for that lesson, and and for
And girls are
not
taught it's not that big a deal. Happens to
right.
everybody. Don't make such
Yeah.
a big deal about it. I mean,
Right.
what just
Absolutely.
happened with with our Supreme Court hearing where
Yeah, we just saw it. Exactly, right? Like, we just saw it. We just absolutely just saw exactly what I think we were all, well, what lots of us were taught. And the thing about that hearing that was so damning is that that man did not take responsibility for anything. Not one thing. You know what I mean? He didn't even take, he did not take, I'm okay, you know, he did not take responsibility for being taught the way he knows we were all taught. He didn't take any responsibility. So my point is that not just Black boys taught Black boys this, but as we see, like, these lessons come from up, you know, they come from up on high. Literally, that lesson young boys just learn, they just learn that from the president via the new Supreme Court judge. And, you know, we watched Clarence Thomas back in the 90s, so we learned it too. You know, so it's like we just learn the lessons everywhere you go. It's not just in rap music. It's actually from in actual politicians. It's in presidencies. It's in policies. Yeah, and I wanted to put a real body and family to those lessons.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Kiese Layman, author of Heavy, an American Memoir. Caroline, did you have some questions?
Well, you know, you lost a lot of weight, right? And
Yeah.
then you unfortunately gained some of it back. And of course, we have all been through that. That's,
Right,
you know,
right.
it's very, very common to happen. So I assume that you have lost it again. You're
I
back
go,
down.
you know, I fluctuate. I go up and down, but I mean, when I lost my weight, I got, you know, I got obsessive. I lost way, way, way
Oh,
too much weight. And so as I got small, I got smaller than I was big. Do you know what I mean? Like, there was a, but the thing was interesting is that when I got, so when I moved to New York at 20, I got a job at Vassar at like 25, 26. Nobody who met me could ever have imagined that I was a big person because I'd lost like 120 pounds, right? So they like, so you know, I just think about sometimes you come into these new places and people have no idea who you've been, like who you really were, like, you know, just a few years earlier. And so when I started to gain a lot of weight again, everybody was like, "Are you okay? What's wrong?" But really, I was sort of just growing back into my body. You know, I was starting to eat again. I was starting to stop exercising so obsessively. But it's just a,
You ran every day, didn't you? Miles and
oh
miles
my
every
God,
day.
I mean, I ran my body into the ground. I would try to run. I would try to run 12 miles every day if I could, at least. Weekends, I would try to do more. And then I would play basketball, which is really, I played basketball in college after I lost my weight. And I played basketball when I moved to Vassar. I played basketball almost every day. I was just punishing. I was just trying to, I mean, it was fun, but also I was just trying to punish my body. And I got to that point, I don't know if you all have been there, where you think, you know, you think that if you're harming yourself, if you push your body till exhaustion, like that, somehow that's supposed to be like the sign of progress,
Oh, no
right?
pain, no
So,
gain, right?
no pain, no gain. Yeah, that's what it was for me. And I just wanted to keep pushing and keep pushing and keep pushing. And then one day, my body was just like, nah, like we don't have anything left. You're not giving us enough food. You're not sleeping, and all you're doing is pushing it. And so my body just broke. And yeah, that's what happened.
So how did you recover from that then? I mean, that must have been really difficult.
I went to the doctor. You know, I didn't get the surgery I was supposed to get. But I took a little time off. And, you know, honestly, it's just something I'm still dealing with. Like, I have a terrible hip. I have a bad hip. I have, like, all these stress fractures up and down both of my legs. And every day it's a fight to see, you know, how healthy I can treat myself. I don't know if y'all experience that. So it's not like you get to this point and you're like, oh, like, I'm delivered. You know, like, I'm never – my relationship with my body is forever healthy. Like, every day I have to, you know, think a lot about – how much I eat, how much I don't eat, how much I move, how much I don't move, how much I push my body. And I just want to do right by my body. I just want to treat my body in healthy, loving ways. But sometimes it's harder than it should be.
Did you find that you were treated differently by other people when you were very thin versus when you were heavier?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways are funny. Like, you know, when I lost a lot of weight, I got a lot more attention from women and from, you know, some queer men. Like, people really, you know, people would just be like, oh, my God, like, can you take off your shirt? Like, things you just never expected people to say. I remember once I went to this gas station. I was just driving through Michigan, and the guy was like, man, I'm not gay, but I just want you to know, dude, you've got the perfect body. And I was just like, wow, okay. That's sweet, I guess. You know, like, so there's that. And, you know, if you're bigger, but it was interesting. It's like, you know, bigger black. I mean, I think sometimes, yeah, I write about this in the book. Like, when I was smaller, like, police sometimes would call me a big black man. You know what I mean? And, like, I'm tall. I'm pretty tall. I was like 6'1", but I was so thin. I mean, I hardly had any body fat on me. And so when I was a really big black man, yeah, I mean, people, police especially, like, treated me.
Like someone to be afraid of.
Oh, my God, not more than that. Like, they, you know, I had police say they saw me throw crack out of windows. Like, I didn't, you know, I don't even eat meat. Like, you didn't, you know, like, I've had police pull guns to my head saying that, like, they felt threatened because of my body, right? Because they thought my body would harm theirs. But, you know, the thing that I don't think people understand about big black men is that often we're trying every which way we can to be smaller, to get out of the way. Like, if I walk out of my house right now and I see white women coming down the street, I'm going to move to the other side because I don't want them to get afraid, because if they get afraid, I could get shot. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so I just
yeah.
don't think sometimes yeah. people think about, like, I'm not saying woe is us, but I'm saying it's just more complicated than this idea like, oh, these big black men are just walking around scaring people. Actually, we're trying to do everything we can not to scare people. Because when people get scared, often we get hurt, you
yeah.
know what I mean? Or we get incarcerated, or we get disciplined in a particular kind of way. So,
well, that's been proven again and again, that's for sure.
Absolutely, yeah. absolutely.
So, now, your mother... Although your circumstances were fairly poor when you were young, she was working on a doctorate degree, right?
Yeah, she was. She was working on her PhD in political science.
And was that a like a good role model for you?
She modeled reading. You know, reading and writing were like the biggest currency. In my house. But the thing about the neighborhood I grew up in is, like, my mom would sometimes be on local television stations talking about politics. And so people would think that we were rich because my mom was on, like, local TV. You know, I think it may be different now, but you know, like, there's an intellectual class and then there's economic class. And,
right,
you
right.
know, she wasn't getting paid to be on television. She wasn't getting paid much from her job at Jackson State. and she was really young and she never had money, so she didn't really know how to value it. But the perception was, oh, they must have a lot of money because, you know, mother's getting a PhD, and we see her on TV talking about politics when that just wasn't, I mean, you know, we just didn't have, there just wasn't much material stuff.
One of my favorite lines from your book is when, you know, you're home, you had more books than anyone else that you knew, but that no one other than your mom that you knew would want to swim in or eat books.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's, I mean, we had so many. Sometimes I joke with her now. I'm like, maybe that's one of the reasons we didn't have any money, because I mean, her bedroom was filled with books. The entire den was filled with books. The living room was filled with books. I had books in my room. There were books all in the back of the car. It was just book. I mean, it was just, she just, my mom is, again, she just really believed that you can read and write your way to freedom. And if you were black in Mississippi, she thought you could read and write your way into a space that protected you from white supremacy. And
do you think it worked?
No. Not at all. I mean, I think reading and writing can. I mean, I'm a teacher. I read and write for a living, but I don't think reading and writing alone can protect you from white supremacy. Like her, she's an example of that, and I'm an example of that. Do you know what I mean? Like what I said. Like when cops have held guns to my head for different things, they didn't ask me what the last book was I read. You know, like they didn't ask me to quote my favorite author. Like they saw a big black man who they deemed as a threat. And like different things have happened in my life. I'm not trying to say reading and writing aren't necessary, but I am trying to say this idea that they can save us. You know, Martin Luther King was one of the most well-read people ever, you know, and my mom also was obsessed with dress. Martin Luther King was like a really great dresser. He was a really great orator, and they killed him. So, you know, Barack Obama read a lot, wrote books. He spoke what people deem the King's English. And, you know, lots and lots of people in this country said he was like a radical, violent Muslim who didn't really even graduate from college.
And so, wasn't there a Harvard professor who got arrested or the police?
Yeah.
He was trying to go into his own
Skip
home.
Gates. He's trying to go into his own house. He got arrested for going into. So my point is, I think reading and writing are absolutely important for the imagination. But the people who sometimes police us haven't read the things they need to read and write to broaden their imagination. Mm. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes. So. Yeah. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Kiese Lehman. He's the author of Heavy, an American Memoir, that deals with a lot of weighty issues.
Yes.
Yes.
I was really impressed by the way you felt about your students, that you wanted to more than just teach them. You wanted to be there for them, because they were all facing difficulties. Many were facing difficulties, and you thought you could help them.
Yeah.
So
I think all of our students are. I did, you know, like I if I could do it over again, I would change some of the things that I did for sure. But I wanted to be the teacher to them that I wish I had, and I think I tried to be the parent to them that I wish I was. I succeeded in a lot of ways, but in other ways I failed. You know what I mean? I didn't really understand how important boundaries were. You know, I was 26 when I got my job. Some of my students were like 22. If they asked me for anything, I wanted to be there to provide it. So if they're in my room talking to me about addiction, instead of saying, you know what, I think you probably should go talk to the counseling center because there are people over there who are trained, like I would sit there and try to talk them through things that I just had actual training in, for example. And those students kept me going. I kept them going. We tried hard. If I could do it again, no, there's definitely be some things I would do differently, for sure.
Well, I think that's true of any teacher, you know.
Yes, absolutely. Right, you teach, absolutely, right? You got to look back and see what you could have done better and try to do that better with the next student. And that's what I try to do. That's
Yeah.
what I try to do.
So you're still, so how many classes do you teach? How many different classes?
So I'm teaching grad students now, and I'm on book tour, so I'm only teaching two right this semester, and I'll teach two next semester. And teaching grad students is a lot different than teaching undergrads, but it's similar principles. Kids, just the students want to be cared for, they want you to appreciate their vision, and then they want you to like teach them things you know. But I think what I learned too late was that they don't necessarily want you to teach them to become you, right? They want you to understand where they who they want to be and maybe help them become that, and not
Yes.
necessarily just model, like become me. And I think early in my career, especially with my writing students, I wanted all my writing students to become me instead of like really thinking about who they really wanted to become separate from me.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, but I've learned a lot from that experience.
Now, your first book was a novel.
Yes.
And have you written much other fiction other than that?
Yeah, I'm working on a novel now. It's called And So On. Sort of a futurist novel. And I'm working on a children's book and like a YA book and working on some television stuff right now. So I got
Wow.
my plate is pretty full
I
with
guess.
writing stuff
So
right now.
essentially, you
So
want to
we'll
cover every genre of writing.
I want to try. And if I fail,
Poetry.
I
You,
fail. But
I bet you write poetry too.
I definitely do write poetry, but I never show people that because it's so bad. It's so bad.
About
It's
songs? Have you written
terrible.
any songs?
I've definitely written songs, and I will never share those either.
So, a lot of writers do kind of stick with, their historical fiction writers or their nonfiction writers, or their young adult writers. Now, there are definitely some that try and do a lot of different forms, but why do you think that you are, instead of sticking with fiction or sticking with essay, why do you want to write so many different types of
Well, I just
writing?
want to tell a lot of different stories, and some stories I want to tell seem to make more sense in different forms, So this story I wanted to tell, I needed to use fictive like technique to tell the story that you read in Heavy, but I didn't want to write a book about a mother and son who experienced what I experienced. I wanted to actually, for purposes of making my mom and I talk, I wanted to actually write a non-fictive book. And so for this next project, because it's set in the future, I want to ask questions of the future, and imagine answers. And to do that, I needed to write fiction. This other kids book I'm doing, I just wanted to play with this idea of like, I don't want to give it away, but play with this idea of like the bus and like physical variation, like variations in like kids' head shapes and hand shapes and the way the way kids like a simple memory while moving on a bus. And to do that, I had to do it in the form of a children's book because I didn't want to write like a grown-up book about it. So for me, it's just like the story dictates the genre to me, the kind of stories I want to tell. And
And do you have more ideas for stories than you have time to write?
oh yes, indeed, especially now. Especially, I'm on book tour right now, and that just takes a lot of time. But yeah, I have so many ideas. I hope I can get to like just like a fifth of them. But if I can't, at least I just want to do the ones that I do justice.
Do you, when you
Yeah.
come up with an idea, how do you hang on to that? Is there a place that you record all your ideas, that you write it down
Well, I just write
somewhere?
again. My mom, she gave me my writerly practice. I write for a significant amount of time when I wake up. I write for a significant amount of time before I go to sleep, and I have a notebook that I just jot. If something comes in my head, I just jot it down, and then I try to write more about that at night. And on the weekends, I try to revise the things that I've written during the week. And that's just been my writerly practice for what, 30 something years, and so that's what I try to do.
So your books, as you're writing them, you've been working the whole time too, so that you just write in the mornings and evenings and weekends?
Wow. Yeah, right, because I'm a teacher, you know, I have to go to work and go to meetings and do all of that teacher stuff.
Yeah. So tell us about book tour. How's your book been received on the book tour?
Oh, it's been amazing. I mean, I've been shocked at the way people have been so kind. A lot of times they want to share their experiences, but mm-hmm. there's just been like a ton of people have been coming out to tell me thank you for writing this book, and I just never imagined so many people would be impacted by something so particular, you know.
Mm-hmm. So are you doing book festivals and bookstores?
Yeah, I'm doing books. I'm doing both. And so yesterday, and I'm going to colleges and talking.
Oh,
so I did a festival, and last festival I did was like a week ago. No, actually, it was a humanities festival 2 or 3 days ago in Chicago. And then came back from there, and then the next day I just did an event in Memphis at Lemoyne Owen College, and tomorrow I'll go to New Orleans to have a conversation with Jesmyn Ward in this big old Coliseum type thing, and then I'm going to University of Georgia the day after that, and so it's just,
my gosh,
wow,
always on the road right now, but now, I'm very thankful.
Did you do that much with Long Division and your essay collection as well, or is this the first time?
I did it. Well, you know, I did book tour, but like that was those two books came out with independent press, so you know I had to be my own publicist and I had to drive all the places, and so now it's really different now. You know, they fly me everywhere and make sure everything is great, and so I'm used to being on the road, but not at big venues like this. And
this book was published by Scribner. How did you get a large traditional publisher? Do you have a great publishing story for us?
Well, I mean, my first novel, Long Division, was with Penguin Putnam, and they kept asking me to make all these changes that I tried to make, and at some point they were like, we need you to take it out of Mississippi and take the racial politics out of it. So at that point I realized this wasn't the place for me, so I gave them all their money back, and then I just decided to go independent with this place called Agate, and we ended up selling like 50,000 copies of both of those books. And so after we sold so many copies, you know, agents and publishers then wanted to work with me because they saw that I was able to sell a lot without them. So they thought, okay, let's see what we can do if he actually has some help.
Wow. So was it a difficult choice for you to go with a traditional publisher since you already were having so much success?
Oh, no. It was, I signed a terrible book deal. I got pennies for every book I sold. I needed help. I was literally doing it all by myself. So I knew that I needed, you know, book writing should be collaborative, right? Like, and so I knew who I wanted to collaborate with. I knew how I wanted, you know, and thankfully they wanted to collaborate with me. And so I definitely did not want to do the independent thing again. I had that choice, but it was cool for me to do, you know. I'm glad I have that experience, but I hope I never have to do that again.
Once and done, huh?
One and done. That's it. But I'm so thankful for y'all for reading the book and wanting to have this conversation. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's our pleasure. We've been doing this for 12 years now. And
wow.
Yeah. Talked to some really, you know, many, many great writers, and it's been a lot of fun. So Heavy was a 2018 Kirkus Prize finalist and won the Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence. So can you tell us a little bit about those awards?
So, you know, Kirkus reviews pretty much all the books that come out, and then and in the field of nonfiction, they look at all of their starred books. So they, you know, if they really like your book, they give you a star. And then once they look at all the stars, they take those starred books down to, I think, 5 or 6. And so my book was one of the 5 or 6 books that they picked for best nonfiction book for 2018. And then they had the ceremony in Austin, and Rebecca Solnit actually won that like a week ago, 2 weeks ago. And the Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence means a lot to me because it's like librarians across the country pick that. And then so they have a long list of like 20 of what they consider the best nonfiction books of the year. And then you reduce that 20 down to 3. And so I'm a finalist. I'm one of the shortlist finalists for that. They have that. They don't announce that till January. But yes, I'm one of the finalists for the Carnegie Medal.
So were you over at the Texas Book Festival in Austin?
Yes, that's where I was. That's where the ceremony was.
Right. I went to that last year. I live part time in Austin because my grandkids are there, and But I wasn't this year. Well, last week I was in China, so I couldn't make it to the festival.
Oh wow.
She gets around. She gets around.
Yeah, that's serious.
And right now we're in Iowa, so that's.
I taught at Iowa last year.
Oh, at the University of Iowa, the Summer Writing Festival?
Uh-huh.
Oh.
Not the summer, just I taught. I was, they have this thing called like a distinguished visiting professor. So I was there for one semester.
Oh, at the Iowa Writers Workshop?
At the for nonfiction.
That's
fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
it was
do
great.
Do you think you would ever, if you had this option, which you may, as successful as this book has been, to just write full time and not teach, would you want to do that?
Nah, I love teaching. I mean, I guess if I won the lottery, I don't know. I still would teach. Like, I just love. The teaching is more important for me than the writing. But it's all they're all kind of related. But I really love just being in classrooms and thinking and talking about ideas and words. So I don't ever want to give up teaching, but if I have to, I would have to, but thank goodness I don't have to.
No.
Well, I think good teachers are really the most important thing in our culture, as far as I'm concerned.
That's what I think. That's definitely what I think. I mean, absolutely. And that's why I think teachers obviously need to be, especially teachers at, you know, the middle school and preschool and high school levels need to be compensated fairly. They need to be given time off. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think we value what teachers have to do. Like, they we just don't value it at all, you know? So.
Oh, I agree. And I remember some few years ago, maybe some teachers were trying to get higher pay or something. And I remember seeing this newscaster guy criticizing, well, you know, they don't even work in the summers and they're making X amount per year. And I'm like, and how much are you making on this, you know, network news show? And what good are you doing versus the good that those people are doing? It almost feels like in our society, we pay people in inverse proportion to the actual good they do for society.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
no
you're
question.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No question.
Of course, in the summer, then teachers have to go to take classes to, you know, upgrade their skills and so forth. And, you know, so we don't just get to loll around in the summertime, as I recall.
Right. Yeah. Right. But that's what people... Yeah, I don't know. I don't understand it. I don't understand how they're just not like a value. I mean, we all know how we've all been in classrooms, right? So we know how important healthy classrooms are, vibrant, great teachers who are like, well funded. We all know. So it just seems like it should be the easiest thing in the world to say, okay, like this is actually as important as like defense spending or whatever, whatever, wherever all the money goes. It just seems like that we should all know it's important, but we don't, especially Mississippi, like they do everything possible to gut public education here. And
And then there's, the problem with how schools are funded with property taxes so that wealthy areas have better schools than poor areas, where in some ways the state should be spending more money in the poor areas per capita than in the wealthy areas because they need it more. It's like they
I
don't
agree.
have as
I
much
agree.
opportunity for enrichment outside the classroom. It's so backwards.
Yeah, and they have to
And
prepare.
then I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
And then it also just it like there's certain things that like I just get weirded out sometimes. So like I'm not gonna make this about Donald Trump, but then you have somebody like Donald Trump who went to the best schools ever. Like he theoretically like he went to the schools that we all want to send our children to. And then I'm always like, oh well, so there's proof that going to the best schools doesn't make you the most caring person in the world.
That's right.
Or the most
Oh, yeah.
intelligent.
Or the most intelligent, or the most thoughtful, so
Or it's or
yeah.
I hate to say it, but even the most well educated.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. That's what I think. That's why I just think we need to really rethink the entire system because something's not working. Something's, and even when it does supposedly work, I just question sometimes whether or not it actually works, So.
So, in your book, you're dealing with, like I said, racism and misogyny and toxic masculinity and all of these really serious issues. But you seem to have a really, kind of a lightness about yourself despite all of this. How do you rise above all of those problems?
I don't know if I do rise above them, but I use humor sometimes to go into them. Do you know? Like I read this book where Richard Pryor was talking about how comedy is like the most important lubricant in the world. Like it can enable us to, get into situations that we would normally not enter. So I don't know. I mean, I think human beings have to deal with a lot of weird things, regardless of race, class, gender, and a lot of things that are like terrifying. And so as an artist, I just want to explore those things. And so I always know that the shape of my journey might be different, but like the constitution and the ingredients are sort of all, I think they're all the same actually. And so if you understand that, you can sort of just know that, like, you're just taking your turn now trying to describe, and then somebody else can try to describe, and then we can listen to both descriptions and see what works and what doesn't, but so I try not to ever think that what I'm experiencing is like I'm the only person in the world, because I think the shape of it might be different, but I know that the ingredients are the same.
Well, everybody is somebody,
Everybody. That's right.
and they have something to say,
That's
and
right. Absolutely.
we should learn to listen.
That's
We should
right.
learn to
That's
listen.
it. We should re That's it. We should learn to listen. That's it. That's it.
Do you have like some real advice for people who want to be writers and are struggling with trying to write?
My advice is more about revision than writing. I think that if you can free yourself up sometimes to get through what people call writer's block, if you don't make yourself believe that everything that you write has to be good or perfect, Like, my mom taught me when I was a kid that you sometimes have to write 50 sentences to find two or three that are good. And I think if you just work with that, you just know that, like, you don't have to be precious with the work. You don't have to think it's good just because you wrote it. You just can become lost in, like, the discovery of good sentences and good descriptions and good characters. I think sometimes students are just like kind of like crumble under the anxiety of having to write, the perfect sentence. And it's just, that's the thing. Like, Morrison to me is one of the greatest writers ever. And she practiced, right? Like, she wrote a lot of bad sentences, and Baldwin wrote a lot of bad sentences, which means that I'm gonna write a lot of bad sentences. And I just think if you think about it that way, you can just take a little pressure off of yourself.
Is that why she had you write the 10 sentences all the time?
I don't know why she did that, to tell you the truth, but man, I used to get on my nerves.
It sounds like your mother gave you lots of like writing assignments outside of school.
Oh yeah,
And you
way. I
did
mean,
them.
I had to do them or else. But I would write. I would. Yeah, I had to write far more outside of school than I did at school. Far more. Far more.
Now, do you have any like entire manuscripts that you wrote that have never been published?
Oh yeah, but they never been published because they're bad.
How many bad novels did you write before you got to the good one?
Oh my God. I mean, when I was in grad school, I wrote this like 600-page novel that I thought was like the best thing ever. And, when I went back and revised it, literally there were probably like 12 pages in that thing that I actually used to put when I wrote my first novel. But
Wow.
if you would ask me at the time, I would have been like, man, I just wrote the best book in the world, So I have all of that. I have all of that book somewhere. I have a few other books that I just, like, yeah, you gotta write bad books to write good books. I just think that's true. I just think that's true.
And
Yeah.
are you a kind of a what they call pantser?
What's
You
that
know
mean?
what that means? You write
No.
by the seat of your pants, you don't plot it all out, you just sort of forge ahead with it.
It depends on the project. Like, when I'm doing novel writing, I really do need to do
An outline.
outlines and character sketches, and I need to sometimes draw, like try to draw the place or the scene. Like, when I'm doing novel writing, I don't think you I have to have I can't just do it by the seat of my pants. If I'm doing memoir, I just have to write a ton of drafts, but I'm not thinking as much about plot initially. I'm just trying to get it out, and then I'll artfully put it together. But novel writing kind of requires a lot of plotting and planning, and
Well, that makes sense.
yeah.
Well, Kiese, unfortunately, we're out of time.
Yeah, I am too.
But it's been a
Thank
great
you.
pleasure talking to you. And Mom, do you have some final words of wisdom?
I do. Here's to kind women and caring men. May we know them. May we raise them. May we be them.
I just love that. I love that so much. Thank y'all so much.
Oh, you're
Oh,
so
you're welcome.
welcome. Thank you for being with us, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Bye-bye.